Welcome to Line One, your health connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. After skin cancer, prostate cancer is the most common cancer affecting U.S. men. The outcome is dependent on many factors. Good communication between the patient and physician is important, but so is the ability of the patient to make effective decisions. Today, we will discuss these issues and address three questions every man should be asking their physician about prostate cancer. My guest is social and health psychologist, Dr. Michael Diefenbach of Mount Sinai School of Medicine in New York City. He develops and evaluates innovative approaches to improving patient knowledge, and he has a particular interest in decision-making and health communication. He leads a research program that aims to improve decision-making and patient-physician communications. Dr. Diefenbach, welcome to Line One.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We have addressed prostate cancer several times in the 10 years or so I've been doing this program, but this one is a little different in that we're going to be dealing with behaviors with men that are around the issue about prostate cancer. So how did you become interested in the issue of patient decision-making and medical issues in particular?
Well, I was, as a health social psychologist, I was always interested in how men and women make health decisions. So, for example, why do people still continue to smoke even though they know that they shouldn't smoke? And since I worked at a cancer center and I had good contact with the urologists and the radiation oncologists at that time, I noticed that a lot of patients had difficulties, a lot of men had difficulties making a treatment decision when they were diagnosed with prostate cancer. And so that's how we started, how this research program started, by developing programs to help patients make effective treatment decisions that they think are right for them.
I was really pleased but also surprised that a cancer research center was involved in this particular issue. I would think it doesn't bring a lot of money to the institution and much as in research, but it was pleasing to see that people are addressing this very basic kind of rubber meets the road kind of information that I think is very important and often gets overlooked. Is this something that the urology group at Mount Sinai got interested in, or is it through the oncology department?
I'm right now working with the urology department, and our group really has embraced more of a multimodal treatment approach, and that is that patients who come to Mount Sinai have the opportunity to see a surgeon as well as a radiation oncologist, and so get treatment information from different sources that will make it a little bit easier for them to make a treatment decision. See, one of the problems that we have is that prostate cancer is treated by different specialties. Urologists are usually surgeons, and they are trained as such. And so it's just like everybody else. They are most comfortable in discussing the treatment options to the patient that they have been trained in. And the radiation oncologists, they treat many forms of cancer with a radiation treatment, not necessarily surgery, and they are more comfortable in treating the prostate cancer with radiation. So the upshot is that patients who see a surgeon or a urologist, in most of the cases, receive a treatment recommendation that is focused on the removal of the prostate, and if they go see a radiation oncologist, that person will often discuss in more length and recommend a radiation treatment for him. So now the patient is in this bind that he has to make a decision between two experts, and in most of the cases, the patient is not an expert, and that's where we came in.
Mm-hmm. Are there specific times when one treatment option is a better one, or is this a common problem with most men with prostate cancer?
Well, most men with prostate cancer in the area of prostate-specific antigen testing are diagnosed at an early stage. So if the diagnosis is really at an early stage and there are no other comorbidities, that means that there are no, the patient does not suffer from other illnesses that would preclude different treatment options, then the patient would have the option of treatment or doing watchful waiting, or as it is called now, active surveillance.
Okay, let me remind our listeners who might be listening today that if you've got questions or comments, there's a couple of ways to get a hold of us. You can call me toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. If you're in Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. And over the next hour, you can email at line1. You have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@kska.org. Our topic is prostate cancer, but we're really looking at not so much the treatment as how we understand our options for treatment and how communication might be improved between the patient and the providers. Let's take just a second, Dr. Dieffenbach, to go back and talk about what is a PSA? How does that factor into this discussion about prostate cancer for sure?
Well, the PSA is the prostate-specific antigen. It's a test. It's a simple blood test, and that blood test is there's a small sample of blood that is taken. It is analyzed, and the prostate-specific antigen is a protein that is secreted by the cancer in the prostate. And the amount or the level of that antigen in the blood is oftentimes an indication of that there is cancer present. And there are different cutoff values that the physician will discuss. And it has been used as a screening tool.
And like many screening tools, it is particularly needs to be important to understand that it doesn't, it's not perfect. There may be false positives, people who have high levels who do not have cancer, and then some people might even have cancer without a specifically high level. So it's not perfect. Is that fair to say?
Right. That's exactly right. The PSA level can be elevated by a number of influences. For example, a just benign enlargement of the prostate leads to an elevated PSA level. Sexual activity the night or the day before the PSA is taken leads to some elevation. So oftentimes the PSA is elevated and there is no cancer indeed.
Let's get to some of the issues around decision making, and I know you've promoted this idea or this question that there are at least three questions that every man should be asking their physician regarding prostate cancer. So let's address those questions and why they're important.
Yeah. So the first question that the patient should ask this doctor, and it's what is the stage and the grade of my cancer. So this the stage is measured in a number, and the physician can detail that. So it's a low grade or a medium or an advanced stage, and then the grade is also called the Gleason score, and that is also a number that is derived from a biopsy that is taken from the prostate. And the tumor samples are taken. They are examined under the microscope by a pathologist, and then there is a grading system that was developed by Dr. Gleason and that in many years ago, and it is still in effect. And again, the higher number would indicate a more aggressive kind of cancer, and that really sets the stage for informed decision making. So that would be the first question. The second question then is, what are my treatment options that I have? And really go ask for all of the treatment options. And those would be the surgical removal of the prostate, external beam radiation, internal radiation in the form of seeds, also called brachytherapy, or active surveillance. that's the fourth choice, that is being not doing any active treatment right now, but just observing the PSA level over time. And for prostate cancer, that is a really good option, especially for the lower stage cancer, the early stage and localized cancers, because prostate cancer is a very, very slow growing cancer and a slow growing disease. And so then, and then the third question again is a follow up question on the active surveillance option: is do I really need to get treated, or can I engage in active surveillance?
Okay. It seems then that, you know, thinking about your questions, that this everything kind of follows from the PSA brings you perhaps to the physician, and then the staging and grading after a biopsy then drives these other options, if I understand you correctly. And so that's the sequence of events that leads you to make these decisions.
Right. And this is really, and I think that you really delineated that very, very correctly. A lot of professional organizations recommend that the decision to be tested for prostate cancer should be done with the physician and the patient should discuss the pros and the cons of that decision. I mean, in we commonly think that testing is a good thing for us, because we know that whether we have a disease or we don't have a disease. In prostate cancer, that is not necessarily the case. If you don't have a family history of prostate cancer, if you are not of African American descent, then one that the man should really think about whether he would want to engage in PSA testing, because it leads him to down this road of repeated testing, emotional distress, maybe false positive results of the testing, biopsies, maybe repeated biopsies, maybe even treatment that might not be necessary. Mm-hmm. So it can really be all very disruptive, and with a substantial emotional cost, and also a cost to the healthcare system that is involved in that decision. But by all means, I'm not advocating that patients or that men should not be tested. I'm just saying that this is a decision that should be made with care and with thought.
Yeah, backing up before this, the biopsy and the grading of the cancer. Let me imagine a 60-year-old man who has had a series of PSAs that are slowly rising over time. What are the factors that drive that next decision to get the stage and the grade, the biopsy done? Is it reasonable to watch at that point, for example, as opposed to after you get the biopsy done?
Well, there it really depends on the level, how high that is. If the cutoff value that is commonly accepted is 4 nanograms per milliliter of the PSA, so that's the magic number that that you hear a lot in the literature, and then the other issue that is also being discussed is how fast the PSA rises, and there we have something that is called the PSA doubling time. So let's say that in January you have a PSA of 0.5, and 6 months later it is 1.0. That's a doubling time of 6 months, and that might be concerning, especially if the next doubling time might even be more rapid.
Mm-hmm. Why, you mentioned African Americans briefly in the previous answer. Why would this issue be a little bit more important to them?
Well, we know from epidemiological studies that African Americans have a higher incidence rate, so there are more African Americans that are diagnosed with prostate cancer, and they are also diagnosed with more aggressive forms of prostate cancer. And so the general recommendation is that African-American men should be tested or should undergo PSA screening starting at the age of 40. And if they have a family history, then they might even start a little bit earlier.
Are men, in your experience, or do we have evidence that how well men do at making decisions regarding this issue of prostate cancer?
Well, unfortunately, our experience shows that men are not that great in making these decisions. From our studies, what we know is that patients in general, but also men, need help in asking the right decisions or asking the right questions. So what that means is, imagine the man who has just been heard that he said that he's been diagnosed with prostate cancer. Probably the first time he hears that, nothing, he will not hear anything else that the physician will tell him. And it's very distressing to hear. And if you hear the cancer word, then you oftentimes, men think, well, that's the death sentence. Well, for prostate cancer, it really is not. And I think that's the most important thing that patients should know, is that they do have time to learn about the disease. They do have time to make a good decision. And men, unfortunately, are just not as good in dealing with the medical system. And this sounds like a generalization and a stereotype. And there is some evidence in that just from how men are being socialized, and that the women in the family are usually taking care of the medical issues within the family. And so men are much more removed from the medical system than women are. And I think that works to their disadvantage.
So is it then true to say that women are better at making some of the healthcare decisions regarding their own breast cancer or their partner's prostate cancer than the men are themselves?
I think what women are better at is that not necessarily making the better decisions, but they know how to elicit the help that they need to make the decisions.
Ah, okay.
And so they have a much better support network. They are more comfortable talking about these things. For men, you oftentimes see that they don't want to talk about prostate cancer. They are oftentimes are worried to ask other men about this issue. I mean, remember, this is a disease that has very unpleasant side effects with urinary incontinence and maybe sexual dysfunction. And this goes for many men to the core of how they perceive themselves as being a man. And so admitting that one potentially has a problem in that area is quite unpleasant. And so a lot of men don't necessarily want to do this, and then they go to the physician and say, well, doc, and I've seen this many times, well, doc, tell me what you would do, and then they do it. Or they hear, well, John down the road, he had that, and he had a good experience, so that will work for me. Or he might have not had a good experience, and I'm not going that route either. So there is a lot of indirect social influence that might determine a decision that not necessarily is in the best interest of the patient.
I've heard this issue before, that when a patient is provided with a potentially life-threatening diagnosis, that they really then turn off their listening and really have a hard time hearing anything afterwards. Is that something that we are getting better at helping physicians understand, so that they can stop and then let this process a little bit, or whatever technique may be best, to then make sure that what is next on the agenda is well understood?
Yes, I think that there is the realization that physicians have to take that into account, and I think overall the new generation of medical students are much more trained in bringing the bad news and helping patients, being more emphatic to patients and helping them understand this. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't room for improvement, but I think there is, in general, the realization in the physician community that they have to change and that they have to improve in this area. And there are efforts underway to do that.
Okay. Let me remind our listeners again, if you have questions or comments, our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@kska.org. And also at kska.org, you can find links to some of the information we're discussing today on the program. Mary, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
I had heard about 2 weeks ago or so, or maybe a month ago, that there was a doctor who was looking into isolating the gene for breast cancer and coming up with a vaccine. And I'm curious if they've been able to isolate, you know, what raises your PSA levels. Are there any trials or, you know, work undergoing right now that they're trying to come up with some kind of vaccine for prostate cancer?
Okay.
Again, I'm not a physician, but I happen to know that there is the first vaccine for prostate cancer has been approved by the FDA, and it is available right now for patients, as I believe, not for early stage, but for patients who have a recurrent prostate cancer. So there is no vaccine available, as you might think of the flu vaccine for prostate cancer, but there is something that is being tested right now for later stage disease.
Oh, okay, so not for a prevention, just more of a
treatment.
Yeah, treatment.
Okay. Right.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was an interesting question. I wasn't aware of that. And I'd make the comment, I'm guessing, and you need to correct me, that the vaccines being used for treatment are much like vaccines that are being used for infectious diseases. We're isolating specific proteins on abnormal cells and trying to make our own immune response gin up against that very specific protein that might be on a cancer cell to help our body destroy that. Is that what's being done?
Yeah, that's the general idea, yes. And as you can imagine, it's incredibly expensive, and the patient is providing his own blood that is then treated and then injected.
Yeah, and then it takes a little bit of time to develop that vaccine then too.
Exactly. Right.
You mentioned earlier that men generally follow the advice of the first specialist they see. Why would that be, and what's good and bad about that?
Well, I think that the patient, a lot of men are familiar with their family doctor, and they refer them to a urologist, and then it really takes a little bit of an effort to get a second and third opinion. And especially if they like the physician and they like what they hear, then they feel it's not necessary to go any further. That is some group of men. There are also others who are getting two or three opinions, and for them it takes they spend a lot of time researching the different treatment options. And for them, it is also sometimes very hard to make a decision because they have so much information available.
Right. And some of it may be contradictory.
Right, exactly. That's the point. There is a lot of contradictory information. And I think I intimated that earlier when I said that there are different specialties recommend different treatment options that are are quite different and have a certain side effect profile that is comparable, and there is just no no studies have been done that show which outcome, and these studies are also not ethically possible to randomize men into different treatment options and then try, and then watch who will survive longer or who will have the better outcome.
So this, so the reason why there may be contradictory information is multifactorial. There may be that one physician has a little bit more information about one treatment option than another physician, but at the same time, we really don't have all the information for the best physicians or the most knowledgeable to always know what is the right decision for each individual patient.
Yeah, I think that's correct. We really have we really don't have the gold standard information available that is based on a randomized controlled trial that says in these cases this treatment performs better than in these cases. So we do a lot with what we call case series, where we're looking at large group of patients that that have been treated within a hospital or maybe by a specific physician, and compare those to others that are treated in a different hospital by a different group of physicians. But there are, just because it is not randomized, there are biases introduced that don't allow us to say, here, this one is really truly better than the other.
All right, we're going to take a short break. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection in Anchorage. You can reach us at 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and our email address, line1@kska.org. After the short break, we'll continue to take any calls you have, and you can also email us, and we'll discuss these questions with psychologist Dr. Michael Diefenbach on Line 1, Your Health Connection.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen to Line 1, Your Health Connection again, tune in tonight at 8. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking telephone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, Line 1 will be available on our website at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host. My guest today is Mount Sinai School of Medicine health psychologist, Dr. Michael Diefenbach, and we're talking about prostate cancer, not so much the purely medical issues, although we're certainly beating around that bush, but really about decision-making and health communication. If you have questions or comments up until about just before 3 o'clock today, you can email us at line1@kska.org. You can give us a call at 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752. And remember, if you're listening tonight between 8 and 9, you're listening to a rebroadcast, and we would not be available to answer questions. Although this seems like a rather straightforward question, I wondered what your comment might be. Is what are the consequences for men that are making rather poor decisions regarding their prostate cancer? Obviously, things can get worse, but are there other other things that we need to be aware of that are consequences of this?
Well, one of the things that we see sometimes among prostate cancer patients is that what we call decisional regret, that they chose a treatment and then they regret that they have chosen that treatment, and they are quite unhappy with their decision, and they might blame the physician for that decision, and usually this has something to do with side effects that they experienced that they didn't expect. So one of the lessons that we have learned is that the more time we devote to tell patients what are the different options and what are the different side effects that they might experience, including the likelihood with which those might occur, the better it is in terms of avoiding these kinds of situations.
Okay. All right. What about the women involved with the men, the mothers of the men perhaps, and the wives? What do they need to know about prostate cancer?
Yeah, that touches a little bit on what we talked about earlier. The women are very, very important, but I think that they are oftentimes instrumental in helping get information to the patient, interpreting information. They are often accompanying the patient to the doctor's visit. They often ask questions or they take notes, and they help the patient to understand the information, and oftentimes the decision that is being made is a joint decision. We have seen that in our studies quite a lot, that that they come to a common decision that that is then being pursued. And so for the wives or the spouses and partners of in the life of the prostate cancer patient, one of the things that they should also remember is that it is not a death sentence and that they do have time to think about these issues.
How do people go about understanding or learning about options that are beyond what they may have been told by the physician or specialist that they're seeing initially?
Well, see, this is one of the problems that led us to develop this an interactive multimedia website to help patients understand and learn about the disease. So we talked earlier that about the initial shock of receiving a cancer diagnosis, and that a lot of the things that the physician then says to the patient is really not processed. But once they're at home, a lot of people then go to the internet and try to get some information there. And the internet is great for all sorts of things, and there is a lot of good information on it, but unfortunately there's also a lot of bad information out there, or just outright wrong information. And so we decided to develop a program that provides comprehensive information about the different treatment options, and that also combines information from prostate cancer survivors, and also has information by prostate cancer doctors on this in this program, and the patients can access it at their leisure. The information is unbiased and is all sanctioned by the National Cancer Institute and has been vetted by the National Cancer Institute. And so once the patient is ready, or once the couple is ready to think about this, they would have a comprehensive information tool at their fingertips to learn about the disease without distractions and without the need for them to figure out what is good information and what is bad information.
And that's the Prostate Interactive Educational System?
Yes, this was the first of such programs, the Prostate Interactive Education System. If you Google that, PIES, you will find a link to it, and it is available on the web. We also then have a current study that is the second version, a little bit of an improved version, that is the and you can get information there on the prostatehealingchoices.com website, and there's also a telephone number listed that patients can call and to be part of that study. And this is an ongoing study, so I encourage everybody who is diagnosed with prostate cancer to call, to go to this website or to call that number. And that number is 1-866-258-7981. And they will then, after a few questions, will be enrolled in that study, and they will be able to get access to this information.
Okay, 1-866-258-7981. And also, the links to these sites are on our website at ksk.org/line1 as well. Okay. Do women do a better job of asking about treatment options than men do?
Well, I think that women are a little bit more savvy, just because they had more contact with the healthcare system, just because they were being seen by doctors and gynecologists for much, much longer than men are seen by any specialists. They are also usually the ones who take care of the kids, if they have any, and go to the pediatrician. So I think they're a little bit more comfortable in dealing with the medical system, and so that I think helps. There are just a couple of very simple things that patients can do to make sure that they get all of the information that they need. So one is, if you go to a physician, think about what are the questions that you want to ask. Write them down. Bring a notepad with you and something to write. Bring a friend or your spouse with you so that somebody can take the notes while you're talking, and while the physician is talking. And then try to repeat the information that the physician is giving you. So if the physician says, take these pills every day, then you can ask, well, when should I take them? In the morning or in the evening, with food or without food? So, and the same kind of principles also apply to these more complex kind of decisions that involve a cancer diagnosis. So I think it is very useful to think about all of the questions that one might have and just write them down and then ask them.
Do you have advice for patients who really just didn't quite understand what was being discussed? I can envision that even though they're mentally alert, they're on task, they still may be confused about understanding. What suggestions would you have in that case?
Well, I think that unfortunately happens a lot, and oftentimes patients are reluctant to ask the physicians because the physicians, they feel they don't want to ask any, in quote, stupid or inappropriate questions, but there are none of those. And they also might have a feel that they just don't know which questions to ask. And again, programs like ours help patients to know what kind of questions to ask, because we give a list of those questions. So when you are it is very simple then to print these questions out and ask them. You might also ask the nurse if you feel that you don't get through to your physician, and then if you really don't get through, then this might also be a good time to look for a different one and get a second opinion.
Okay. With the idea that if you're really not getting understood real well, no matter how much you try, that perhaps it's not all your problem.
Exactly. Right. Okay. Right.
Yep. All right. We have another caller. Larry, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, I've been diagnosed with benign prostate hypertrophy and am being treated with tamsulosin. And I'd like to know if you're... expert has any comments about how that relates to potential cancers.
So your question is, if you have benign prostatic hypertrophy, is there an increased risk for a cancer diagnosis?
Right.
Okay.
As far as I know, and again, I'm not a physician, but as far as I know from the literature, this is not a predictor of prostate cancer. It is not necessarily that you are at an increased risk.
That's good.
Yeah. Have you been getting PSA tests done?
Yes, for years and years.
Yeah. Okay.
And they were always elevated.
No, they were always pretty good.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, then I think that it seems like that there has been no negative developments.
So it was just a physical observation on exam, or you have some symptoms related to it, and that's the only problem you're having right now.
Right.
Okay. Yep. That's good information.
Yeah, thank you very much. Good show.
All righty.
You're welcome.
Another bit of information related, maybe a little bit off the subject, but certainly important to me and one of the reasons I'm involved in this program so much is there seems to be a, at least in the last, I don't know, 10, 15, maybe 20 years, an increasing popularity of unproven medical treatment and tests that are, in to my mind, in almost inexplicably popular. There's a lack of evidence. There's a lack of understanding that, of the importance of evidence. Do you have thoughts about why that may be currently an issue?
I think that people are trying to stay healthy as much as they can, and some of the people are willing to try anything that is that they believe is promising. There is also, I think, increased unregulated marketing of these kinds of procedures or maybe supplements, and that's certainly contributes to that problem.
Right. So there's misinformation being provided to a large degree.
I would think so. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I think the other problem is that patients or people are not necessarily educated about what are the right questions to ask.
Right.
I've
heard it said by somebody, and I've used this because I think it's so correct appearing, and I like your opinion, is that the internet is a great or a better place, not a great, but a better place to go once you have a precise diagnosis. It's an absolutely terrible place to go when you don't know your diagnosis.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that, because you really don't know exactly what it is that you're getting.
Yeah, and there's a lot of self-diagnosis that's really not even close to what's going
right.
on.
Exactly, and it can feed in some to some tendencies that are more harmful than beneficial for people. And that can be quite distressing and non-productive.
You've alluded to the fact that perhaps because women are more involved with the healthcare system, that they may be better at trying to find more information and therefore make better healthcare decisions. Are there other factors that are important or that have been studied, such as educational level or income level or parts of the country you live in, or any other factors that, you might have been teased out that might be important to know about?
Yeah, I think that there are, of course, these kinds of educational level and income, certainly they're highly correlated. They certainly are associated with that. Physician recommendation is still the number one determining factor for a treatment decision, and I think with to a certain extent that's the specialist, and we need to trust our specialists. Nobody can be an expert in all of these different kinds of things. I think the difficulty really comes in when you are in a situation where there is not one good treatment option, where there is no when there are many different options, and it depends on the patient's identifying his what he's comfortable with and what he wants to do, and that's where the difficulty is, and it is hard often, and the physicians in our healthcare environment don't have the time to spend hours with the patient to help them figure out what they want and how they can achieve an outcome that is best for them, not only medically, but also psychologically.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left. Let me give our listeners our number and contact information again. If you've got questions or comments, you can email me at lineone, lineone at kska.org. Our local number, 550-8433, and our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Back to prostate cancer again, then. Is there some important issues regarding the lapse of time or the time between diagnosis and the initiation of treatment that is important also in these decision making?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that that is important to realize is that patients do have time to make a treatment decision. The prostate cancer is a slow-growing disease, and as most of the cancers are diagnosed at an early stage, there is no need to treat that treat the prostate cancer within days or so. Patients have time; they have weeks, they have months before they need to make a treatment decision. Or, as I said before, it might even be appropriate to not to engage in active surveillance, and that is the monitoring of the PSA and regular intervals, having a biopsy to see how and if the cancer progresses or not.
Mm-hmm. Why don't we go ahead? I do have another caller. I think I'll go ahead and take Bill at this time. Bill, what can we do for you?
Yes, I've just been recently diagnosed with prostate cancer, and it was a Gleason score of 9, very aggressive. And my doctor proceeded to take bone scans and CAT scans immediately and determined that it had spread to a seminal vesicle outside the prostate and created a fairly sizable tumor, but it had not spread to bones or other organs. This all occurred back in the lower 48 a couple months ago, and the doctor that I have is extremely well recognized. I've done a lot of research on this. He's very good and very objective in the decision-making process. He's recommended a program of hormonal treatment for 4 to 6 months until the tumors hopefully shrink enough that he can safely do surgery. It appears that because it's outside the prostate, there aren't too many other good options. But I have friends and relatives that recommend strongly that I should get a second opinion. But I really have faith in this doctor, and he's got a fantastic reputation nationally. Am I being unwise if I don't get a second opinion?
Well, that's a difficult decision. If you feel comfortable with that person, then and you trust him, I think that that's fine. I think a second opinion can usually doesn't hurt, and if there is somebody available with a similar kind of expertise and recognition, then I might do that actually.
Would Dr. Diefenbach, would your websites that you developed help him work through this issue specifically, or is his issue too specific for that?
I think that Bob's issue is fairly specific, and we have really focused on the early stage treatment. But you might want to think of also talking to a radiation oncologist, because there might be some multimodal treatments available that combine the surgery with radiation afterwards.
Okay, Bill, sorry for interrupting.
That's exactly the option I wondered about, Doctor. And what my doctor tells me is that if we go with radiation initially, it rules out surgery later, whereas with the surgery, we can always do the radiation later if it either returns or didn't get enough of it the first time.
The physicians in our institutions do is that they do the surgery first and remove the prostate and the seminal vesicle, and then radiate the prostatic bed and a certain restricted area.
Okay, that's consistent with what he's recommending. Okay. Appears to be a very aggressive case. So I've been tracking my PSA very well, but this came up all of a sudden. Hmm.
So it was a sudden change in the rate of increase?
Yes.
Yeah. This is also something that I mentioned earlier, that the Gleason score that indicates the the aggressiveness oftentimes determines what your treatment options are and might even narrow the treatment options. So for you, watchful waiting is not an option. And a combination of therapies seems to be what is indicated.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good luck.
All right.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Yeah,
good show. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
So Bill's problem is really right there at the crux of what we discussed earlier, is that we're not at a point where for some individuals a precise, exact, state-of-the-art, this is the way you do it, answer may be there. He needs more information, and he needs to be talking with people with good experience in making the best decisions.
Absolutely, yes.
Tell us about your current research. What are you studying? Why is this important? Are you recruiting patients, as you mentioned earlier, and so forth?
Yeah, so my research program is focuses on the general area of health communication and treatment decision making, and I'm fortunate to have two different areas. One is the research. One is the very basic psychological processes involving treatment decision-making, and we're looking at how people think and how their emotions impact the decision-making process. And this is what we would call basic psychological research. And then we also have a program that is informed by these basic processes, where we develop interventions like the PIES that we have mentioned, or the Prostate Healing Choices program that translates and applies what we have learned earlier from these more basic studies into very applied tools and interventions that help patients then make treatment decisions. And the research that we are doing in my group and with collaborators throughout the country is really always goes between those two areas, that we're having the more basic and applied work, and then translated into programs that help patients, because that's our ultimate goal, is that we would like to make the life of patients easier and help them through these often difficult times.
Are the decisions and the information that you're gathering now generalizable to the breadth of medical decision-making regarding diabetes or multiple sclerosis or alcoholism, for example?
I think that certain basic principles can be generalized. There are as much as there are basic cognitive and affective processes involved. There are also basic ways how people process health information, for example, that we know, that we have studied. There are principles that have been developed in terms of to addressing health literacy, for example, or numeracy, how we present the information, how it is presented on paper versus how it should be presented on a screen. We know how people interact. At least we start to learn how people interact with computer programs, and we slowly learn more about how patients know and learn and deal with numbers, for example, and statistics. So all of these kinds of processes can be applied to a multiple health context, and prostate cancer is, in a way, a very good laboratory to address these kinds of issues within a medical field. But there are others as well. You might have a different aspect. Diabetes, for example, you have more of a focus on adherence and following up with a treatment regimen over time, oftentimes a lifelong time. That presents totally different challenges than a treatment decision, for example, that has to be done once. So that's a single decision versus a repeated decision.
We only have about 3 minutes left, and I was just thinking back about your comments about how some advertising and so forth relates to addressing the emotional aspects of disease. Is there evidence or do you have comments about physicians, healthcare providers who are better at getting to the personal and emotional aspects of illness in general? Are they better at improving adherence to treatment suggestions?
I think that there is a sizable literature available that demonstrates that if the healthcare provider knows what motivates the patient and how the patient understands the information that is given to her, that that person is also more adherent to the recommendations that are given by the patient. Of course, there are other issues that also influence it, like access to care, health insurance, and educational level that we mentioned before. But there are certain, if the healthcare provider knows what the mental representation is that the patient has about this disease and treatment, then he can frame the messages in such a way that the patient understands it in a much better than if the person would not have that kind of information.
Again, kind of a personal question in the last minute or so. If a patient has misinformation that they are believing, are there techniques that help change that or open the person's mind to another way of thinking about the issue?
Well, I think that's a difficult question. I think what is important is that patients have the opportunity to get information, comprehensive information, but also information that is easy to understand and that brings it, that explains things properly. And I think it always helps to talk to other people about it. And one of the things that we've talked earlier about were these differences in between men and women. One of the differences that we have is that women are much easier to go, or much more willing to go to support groups, share their thoughts, and men are not. And I think in that respect, we find that these kinds of social processes really help and facilitate adjustment and, to a certain extent, also treatment decision-making.
Well, let me say thanks very much for taking the time to spend this hour with us here in Anchorage, Dr. Diefenbeck. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Thanks again to Dr. Michael Diefenbeck, a health psychologist at Mount Sinai School of Medicine. Next week, Line 1 is going to return. We're going to be discussing some common neurologic problems affecting infants, children, and adolescents, things like autism, cerebral palsy, attention deficit disorder, stroke, and seizures. My guest will be Anchorage pediatric neurologist Dr. Rod Smith. I think I said next week, but actually it's going to be 2 weeks. Next week will be July 4th weekend, and we'll be closed on Monday. So it'll be 2 weeks from today. Pat Yak is vice president of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available on our website at kska.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.